Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is Lehman v. Boatwright. Mr. Provis.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am, of course, Tim Provis, and I wrote Ms. Lehman's briefs. I don't believe in lengthy opening statements because I studied oral argument with Arthur Goldberg, formerly of the United States Supreme Court, and his first rule of oral advocacy was, quote, sit down, state your case, and sit down, unquote. And so I will be consistent with my mentor's first rule today. I would like to take a couple of minutes, though, and make one point about precedents versus principles. It's perhaps not well known that the great Dr. Johnson, the dictionary writer, was also a lawyer. And on the subject of precedents, Boswell
who is also a lawyer?
The great Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson.
No, he wasn't.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but he was.
And, no, he wasn't.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want
forget
to
argue it.
About it. It's a matter of history. Anyway, on the subject of precedent, Dr. Johnson had this to say. The more precedents there are, the less occasion is there for law. That is to say, the less occasion is there for investigating principles. And Dr. Johnson's view of that principles and precedents is consistent with Justice Cardozo's.
Mr. Provis?
I'm just wanting to point to a few basic, two basic principles.
Mr. Provis, how about if I ask you a basic question here?
That's okay. Go right ahead.
Thanks. This is Judge Rovner. Do the letters to Mr. Avila, coupled with the shooting incident, support the inference that he was a member of the Latin Kings? And if so,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I have more.
And I realize that, Your Honor, but that isn't this case.
No, that's not the.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is the Batson.
For heaven's sakes.
We changed the order.
Go ahead.
Never mind, as Emily Latala would say.
Thank you. Justice Cardozo's method for decision. In his famous book, The Nature of the Judicial Process, says the judge is confronted with a twofold process. He must first extract from the precedent the underlying principle, the ratio, dissidendi, and then he must determine the path or direction along which the principle is to move and develop.
Okay, here I am again.
Yes, Your Honor.
Hopefully on the right track.
Certainly.
Tell me this. Did Lehman's trial counsel raise the issue of whether the prosecutor had run criminal background checks on the white jurors?
No, he did not.
Okay. If not, would you argue that the court was obliged to raise the issue sua sponte as part of its duty under step three to assess the credibility of the prosecutor's explanation?
The specific issue of whether the prosecutor ran the background checks, I wouldn't think that the Constitution would. Your Honor, I wouldn't. My general view of the matter is the trial judge has a good deal of discretion on how to examine the evidence, and if a trial judge wished to determine that from the prosecutor, that would certainly be consistent with his duties, but I wouldn't think he would be required to do that in any specific case.
Well, under Batson, the defendant bears the burden in step three of showing that the prosecutor's proffered racially neutral reasons or pretext and that the strike was racially motivated. How did Lehman's trial counsel meet that burden?
Well, he was prevented from doing it, is my whole argument, is, let's put it this way, he was prevented from presenting all the evidence that he wished to present. He asked the trial judge to voir dire on the prosecutor's stated reasons because he was questioning their accuracy, and the judge sort of glossed over that request, never really acknowledged that it was made, And so neither the prosecutor nor the judge ever asked the stricken juror any questions about the prosecutor's asserted reason. So I believe that to that extent, and that's part of the heart of my argument, to that extent, the failure to ask questions of the stricken juror prevented counsel from presenting everything that he might have presented on that issue. Now, I do, of course, believe that there
What would he have said that would have been helpful to the judge?
Well, at least two of the prosecutor's reasons were simply not true to my knowledge, and evidence could have been presented on that.
Like what? So what would the prosecutor say that was untrue? What would be one example?
Well, the prosecutor presented this lengthy exhibit of police contacts at the residence, and Mr. Bell didn't live there at the time. So that was one of the things he might have presented, might have said, if he was asked.
But the question is whether the prosecutor is in good faith, not whether he's correct. So how would Bell's testimony have illuminated that issue?
If Your Honor wishes to take that line of reasoning, I guess I don't know of any precedents that find that a prosecutor can both be in good faith and present false reasons.
Well, wait a second. You mean that a person who makes a mistake is necessarily acting in bad faith?
There's nothing in this record that leads me to believe there was a mistake. These were mistakes, Your Honor. I mean, and I think the clincher for that is that when the trial judge asked pointedly the prosecutor why she did not voir dire the juror on these reasons, she said, well, I don't think he's going to answer truthfully. I mean, that if that isn't prejudice, I don't know what is. That's prejudice, prejudging the person's credibility.
Mm-hmm. He's into his rebuttal. He's into his rebuttal. He doesn't know.
Want to save your remaining time for rebuttal?
If there are no more questions, that's fine, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. Then we'll hear from Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, Daniel O'Brien, appears on behalf of the respondent.
Could I just start you right out? Because I have a lot of questions
about
this. The trial court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court seem to have both made the same error, eliminating the third step of Batson or conflating steps 2 and 3. Where in the record can we find that any court applied that third step?
Well, I think it's in the trial court's decision, which the trial court said that the state basically proved, the prosecutor proved the case of a neutral explanation.
But when the trial judge stated that the state has made its case, wouldn't that refer to step 2? I mean, that is where the state needs to proffer
the
race neutral reason. Step 3 does not involve the state's burden at all. So this is very confused reasoning to me.
Well, I mean, I think you have to infer from his finding that the state proved its case that he credited the prosecutor's explanations.
But refers to step 2.
Ruling was made only after the arguments were made back and forth between defense counsel and the prosecutor as to why or why not the state's reasons should be believed. And defense counsel never offered to prove anything beyond the fact that the prosecutor struck an African-American juror.
Well, you know, the trial judge also referred to just cause for the strike, and that sounds like he thought he was deciding whether the state had an adequate reason to strike a juror for cause, not whether a peremptory strike was racially based. Again, if the trial court's ruling gives no indication that it considered step three and actually appears to be very confused about the issue. My problem is trying to figure out how that's a reasonable application of Batson. And I focus on the trial court here because the Wisconsin Supreme Court simply repeated what I view as the same flawed analysis.
Well, I'm not sure what exactly the analysis. I mean, there's no requirement in Batson that there be a full-blown evidentiary hearing where the prosecutor is put under oath or the juror is put under oath, or that any specific individuals have to be questioned. And I point this court to the recent or the 1995 Supreme Court decision in Purkett v. Elam, where and even the recent decision in Rice v. Collins, where the inquiry was quite similar. And in fact, Purkett v. Elam, the court held that the Ninth Circuit conflated the second and third steps in the opposite way, that they applied the proof of racial discrimination, well, the proof of a implausible reason to evaluate the step two analysis when they shouldn't have done that, that they should have they didn't go to the step three analysis when they should have. Here, I believe there was a sufficient inquiry in chambers as to the prosecutor's reasons for striking this particular juror. The defense had plenty of opportunity to question the prosecutor about whether he had done background checks on white jurors, whether he had asked he could have made a record as to whether the prosecutor asked any questions that were racially targeted, such as in the Miller L decision. None of those steps were taken here.
Well, look, everyone seems to agree that it's counsel's credibility that the court was supposed to address. And what help me with this. Where can we find any evidence that the court considered the credibility of counsel's proffered reasons?
Well, if the court did not believe the prosecutor, then it wouldn't have said that the statement met its case. If the court believed that the prosecutor engaged in racial discrimination, it's not going to ultimately conclude after the arguments of counsel that the state met its case of a neutral explanation.
Well, of course, the court never asked the prosecutor if she had run criminal background checks on any of the white jurors.
But that wasn't the court's obligation. As these Hernandez v. New York, Batson itself made clear that burden is on the defendant.
Yeah, but if you are questioning, if you are judging the credibility of her explanation, it seems to me that a trial court should say, look, did you confine your inquiry to the sole African-American or... did you do the same thing for, the white individual? And, you know, many of the reasons that the prosecutor gave would eliminate most, if not all, African-American veneer persons from the jury,
living in a high-crime
neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera.
No, I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bell lived in a house with multiple police contacts over a several-year period. And in response to Mr. Provost's comment that Mr. Bell didn't live there, he said on his jury card that he did live at 1216 Wisconsin Avenue. And the record shows, I think, page 28 of the transcript of the discussion in chambers where the prosecutor said not only were there multiple police contacts, but there were multiple police contacts with people named Bell in that house. Now, it's possible that Mr. Bell was not related to all the other Bells with whom there were police contacts, but I think it's reasonable for a prosecutor to be concerned, and that's all that happened here. Moreover, Mr. Bell answered varies when asked what his employment was, rather than put down any sort of specific job, and that's a factor, a reasonable factor that a prosecutor can take into account. This court has even held that lack of employment is a factor, a race-neutral factor that a prosecutor may consider.
But, of course, she declined, as I recall, to question him on an individual basis. I mean, if she had all of these concerns, or if you think she had all of these concerns, why did she decline to voir dire him on an individual basis?
And again, I point to the Purkett and the Rice decisions where those jurors weren't questioned either by the prosecutor. And the U.S. Supreme Court had no difficulty with that. She could have questioned him, sure. She could have asked, sir, you didn't answer my general questions. Don't you have a criminal conviction? And if you don't your relatives do? Don't the people who live in your house, aren't they a bunch of criminals? She could have asked those things. It's reasonable for her to decide not to and go based not only on her intuition and hunch, but on the actual facts before her in the form of the police report, which listed all the police contacts at Mr. Bell's home and his varied response to the question of employment. Rice v. Collins says the only question for this court is whether it was reasonable for the state courts to credit the race-neutral explanation for the peremptory strike. And based upon the evidence that was put forth by the prosecutor and the lack of evidence put forth by defense counsel, it was reasonable. There's no reasonable conclusion to the contrary. Could the court have asked follow-up questions? Could the prosecutor have asked follow-up questions? Certainly. I agree with Mr. Provost, the trial judge has the discretion to ask all kinds of questions of any juror on voir dire to supplement what the attorneys asked. But that's not mandated by Batson v. Kentucky, and it's clearly, as clearly shown in Perkett and Rice v. Collins, an inquiry of the nature that occurred here is fine. We have two questions here: whether there was an unreasonable application of Batson, we conclude that there was not, and whether there was an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented by both sides, and there was not. That was not an unreasonable determination of the facts when the judge implicitly said, I credit the prosecutor's explanation, and explicitly said the state proved its case of a neutral explanation for the strike.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Oliver.
You.
Mr. Provost, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
I would only like to make 2 points. Counsel just talked about what Batson mandates as far as the trial judge's inquiry. And Batson specifically mandates, quote, that the trial judge undertake a sensitive inquiry into such circumstantial and direct evidence of intent as may be available, which is a quotation in Batson from the famous discrimination case of Arlington Heights. So there should be, this inquiry should be the same as might happen in any other discrimination case. But anyway, the principles I wanted to state were that racial equality before the law is a motivating principle in this case, as well as to some lesser extent due process of law. Now, Justice Cardozo talks about if the principles are not applied in a manner that will help them to move and develop, they will wither and die. Justices Breyer and Souter have now indicated their willingness in their concurrence in Rice to entertain an argument that peremptory challenges will simply be held unconstitutional because the Batson rule is not being enforced. So I think that with any success, and so I think that that's an important consideration for courts considering Batson issues today. That would be my rebuttal.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Provost, Mr. O'Brien.